When cannabis became sort of legal, government piled on the rules, regulations, and taxes that now afford it almost total control. But there is a loophole that some are driving that proverbial Mack truck through. And so we ask, can government gain total control of cannabis?
Welcome to the award-winning Food Chain Radio Show with your host, Michael Olson. And now get ready for 1 hour of What's Eating What Radio.
Well, hello out there. You are tuned into the 1326th edition of the Food Chain Radio Show. Or hey, perhaps you're among our friends way down there in Perryopolis who are tuned into the Food Chain podcast at metrofarm.com. Well, whoever you are and wherever you are, welcome aboard. I am Michael Olson, your host for this hour of What's Eating What. Folks, I recently attended a listening session conducted by California Secretary of Agriculture Karen Ross and members of the CDFA's Board of Directors. I took the opportunity to listen because I thought it would be a good place to hear some what's eating what. And it was. The speakers were those who had something to say about the nation's next farm bill and all the money that will come gushing forth from its implementation. Those who were doing the listening were taking notes, which would then be passed up the food chain to those in Congress and the USDA for consideration. The topics pouring forth included most of those that fill the daily news: water, labor, real estate costs, climate change, and so on. But when Joanna Cedar stood up to speak about the great hemp loophole, I tuned right in. When cannabis became legal in California, the state, county, and city governments all jumped in on the industry and wrapped it up in rules, regulations, and taxes. Now it's almost impossible for those engaged in legal cannabis businesses to compete with those in illegal businesses. In a sense, the industry is right back to its days of reefer madness. Well, here to help us tell of what's eating what up and down the cannabis food chain, we have Joanna Cedar, who is the hemp policy expert at Turpentine Belt Farms and the director of Sonoma County Growers Alliance. Joanna, thank you for joining us today on Food Chain Radio.
It's a pleasure to be with you today, Michael.
Well, you know, when I listened to you present before Secretary Ross and the board, I was really amazed at what a good speaker you were and how forthright you were in making your presentation. Now, something tells me you were a teacher or something like that.
I was. I taught American government and world history primarily at a comprehensive high school in Santa Rosa, California for about 20 years.
So when you stand up in front of a bunch of kids like that, you better know how to speak, right?
Yes. Or they will eat you alive, and high school students are ruthless, but they're also a lot of fun, and they're also in transition to adulthood, which there's always an opportunity to teach to a higher purpose in helping them figure out what kind of adults they want to be. And so it fits in nicely with the subject matter and of American government and helping them learn their rights and responsibilities as citizens of the United States. And so it was a wonderful first career, but I'm on to something else.
Well, good. And with respect to that, how does cannabis fit in with American government?
Well, that's certainly a loaded question. You know, in California, cannabis has always been, you know, at least in my lifetime, for the last 60 years or so, a vital part of the economy, especially in Northern California, where I live. And we've seen attempts over the last maybe 20 years or so to bring cannabis into some type of regulatory structure. But that process really began in earnest with state government in 2015 with the passage of the Medical Marijuana MRSA, Safety and Regulation Act.
So that was kind of the proverbial camel's nose in the tent, right?
Exactly. And it seemed to be going pretty well. And then the voters passed Prop 64. And in doing so, there were a series of policy There were no longer proposals that had to be in policies that had to be implemented because they were part of an initiative and they became the will of the voters. And there were conflicts between OMA or Prop 64 and MRSA, and the priorities in those policies had to be given to the initiative because it is the will of the voters. And some of those policies did not work for the complexity that is California cannabis.
Okay. But before we go there,
sure.
Am I right in saying that it was the will of the California voter to legalize cannabis, but not the will of the U.S. citizens to legalize cannabis? Is that where we're at right now?
I wouldn't say that. I wouldn't say that. And really, this conversation is going to force us to get into the weeds. Excuse the pun. But
I think we're already into the weeds.
We're already there. We are in the weeds. The laws right now are not aligned with the botany of the plant.
Mm.
And you can't make the plant grow differently because you want to regulate it a particular way.
So this this is going to take us in a very interesting direction, especially given your position there at Turpentine Belt Farms.
It's Terpene Belt Farms.
Terpene.
And we are,
not Turpentine.
No, Terpene. Although turpentine is a type of terpene, terpenes are essential oils. They are ubiquitous in nature, and they are found in their highest concentration in the cannabis sativa L plant, which is the botanical name of the plant that is defined by the federal government as both cannabis or marijuana, as they call it at the federal level, and hemp. They are, in fact, the same plant.
Cannabis sativa.
Cannabis sativa L.
Now, what about indica, which is...
Well, indica and sativa are terms that have been used to try to communicate a particular terpene profile of the cultivar. So let me explain that. There are different active components, molecules in the cannabis sativa L plant. Some of them are cannabinoids, and popular cannabinoids that people hear about all the time. One is CBD, which is cannabidiol, and another one is THC or tetrahydrocannabinol. And these two cannabinoids are 2 of 100 that can appear in the cannabis sativa L plant. There's also terpenes. There are terpenes in the oil, and when one smokes or ingests or otherwise brings into their body cannabis, then two things are happening. They're reacting both to the cannabinoids, and they're also reacting to the terpenes. So I like to say the cannabinoid levels determine the intensity of the effect, but the terpenes determine the type of effect. Does it make one hungry or tired or horny or creative? And so it's the terpenes, these essential oils that appear in cannabis, but they also appear in citrus and in lavender. And they are they can be in all sorts of combinations, and the human body interacts with these oils, and so the cannabis plant is kind of complex, mm-hmm. and so there's a lot going on. Indica normally refers to a terpene profile that makes one either body or mind sedated. And sativa generally refers to a terpene profile that makes one body or mind elevated.
You know, that's exactly energized. That's exactly how I would and have described them as well. So it's really the terpene then.
It is the terpenes. And I will say that that most of us who work in cannabis and who are longtime cannabis consumers, we look at the terms indica and sativa, and we say these are not useful terms.
Okay. Well, that's and good. That's something important to establish then.
Yeah. We encourage cannabis consumers to learn the terpene profiles that they are attracted to and then seek those out.
Uh-huh.
Because that is going to be a more efficacious way to pick the products that are going to work for the consumer.
And that really defines the advance, the advances
have
been made in the cannabis industry, because instead of just looking at flowers, we're now looking deep into the flower for the oils that those flowers contain.
Yes, and those oils and those different molecular components can be separated, okay, into isolates and then combined into all sorts of different products.
Am I sensing 100 million different products?
I'm sensing 100 million different products, and I'm also sensing the interest that that traditional CPG companies and pharmaceutical companies are going to have in the cannabis sativa L plant, because terpenes can also be medicines. You know, we know that that cannabinoids can be medicines. Epidiolex is a CBD isolate. Marinol is a THC isolate. There is Taxol, does not come from cannabis, but it's a terpene from the Pacific yew tree, and it's a breast cancer drug. I will say this, that most of us who've worked in cannabis for a long time and have been longtime consumers believe wholeheartedly in whole plant medicine, and believe that that the consumer is benefited best by whole plants because of something called the entourage effect, and the plant acting that the components are more than the sum of their parts in the human body. And so we don't really understand a lot about the entourage effect, but yet there's a lot of research going on in Israel on that. But in general, we are learning more every day and find that the different components in the cannabis plant, when acting together, are more efficacious than any of them acting alone as isolates.
That's interesting. It's kind of like, it's not just your friend, but it's your friend's entourage that also have
Correct.
An influence on everything. Wow, ladies and gentlemen, this is going to be a real fun show with Joanna Cedar, who is a hemp policy expert and at Terpene Belt Farms, and the director of Sonoma County Growers. When we come back, though, I want to go back a little bit and ask Joanna what she thinks of legalized cannabis. Right back. Well, we are back and we're talking about cannabis, the newly minted crop of California. And it was a legal point of discussion with Karen Ross, who is the Secretary of California Agriculture. And there were a number of people at the listening session put on by the CDFA who wanted to know more about cannabis, who wanted to advocate for cannabis in the Farm Bill. And one of them is Joanna Cedar. And she stood up and made a very interesting presentation about the great hemp loophole. But before I get there, I'd like to ask Joanna, as a policy analyst and as a longtime advocate of cannabis, what do you think about the way legalization here in California is going?
Oh, they've done a terrible job. It's estimated that there were probably almost 70,000 small growers of cannabis in California prior to regulation. That is significantly less now. I think that there may be about 2,000 cannabis licenses, but we have, or cultivation licenses. What we really have to look at is who are the people growing cannabis in California now? They used to be small farmers, many of them homestead farmers, augmenting their income so that their kids could live a better life. Many of them are growing cannabis on regeneratively on diversified farms and a small profile, under 10,000 square feet. In contrast, what we have today is we have large farms with stacked licenses, growing in greenhouses, in places where maybe there isn't enough water for them to do so. Perhaps most importantly, in California, cannabis is not regarded as agriculture. It's regarded as an agricultural product. So the regulations that farmers have to abide by are similar to the regulations that a developer might have to abide by when building a shopping center. And what we're really talking about is our plants in the ground. We're not talking about buildings that are being built on raw land. And so I think that the state really got it wrong in terms of not treating cannabis as agriculture. And I think that they also did not do enough to legalize the industry that they had, an industry of small farmers, and missed an opportunity to incentivize all sorts of behaviors that we would like to see in local food sheds, in community microgrids, all sorts of on-farm solutions for larger problems that we could have incentivized through the cannabis permitting and licensing process.
That's a very interesting.
I think they meant well, but we're not there anymore. And just in Sonoma County, as an example, we had about 5,000 small growers in Sonoma County. Now we have growing outdoor and mixed light one, so basically outdoor. We have about 33 unique businesses.
Wow!
So it was transformational to the Sonoma County economy, and what we've done is essentially traded a cannabis economy and a agricultural economy for a tourist economy, and it's very difficult to go back after that's happened. So I'm sad. I've had to tell a lot of my friends who were growing up in the hills and contributing to the local economy, you're done with cannabis, go buy a boat.
And
you can't do it anymore.
Yeah, and fish for no fish.
Right.
Now,
yeah, it's really sad, yeah. What I've seen happen. And I say, well, perhaps the state will one day get it right, and those days shall come again, just not for my generation. It will be a new generation that will, you know, take up that back to the land, homestead, small cannabis farming legacy that right now is becoming extinct.
Now, it seems to be, and here in the county in which I live, there used to be many, many, many retail establishments selling cannabis, and all of them were owned by local people. Now there's just one that's owned by a local person. And the, from what I understand, the industry is pretty much suffering the same thing that you see up there. But the state was not interested in taking care of small farmers, I don't think. What they were interested in is tax revenue. How is that working out?
It's not. I think it's one of the things that we have to understand is that cannabis farmers in California have been supplying the rest of the country for 60 years. And when regulation happened, a state siloed market was developed. And that which is grown in California cannot be sent out of state anymore. And so there was a natural curtailment of the market. And so we don't really have an overproduction problem. What we have is a market access problem. And when very high state taxes that are poorly structured are layered on top of that market access problem, then it makes it very difficult to tell people, consumers in California, to buy their cannabis in the regulated market when it's going to cost them twice as much than in the unregulated market, the duty-free market. This problem is only getting worse, because throughout the country, as a result of the 2018 Farm Bill, hemp inputs, hemp CBD oil from hemp is being chemically converted to not just THC, but all sorts of other cannabinoids, novel cannabinoids in the lab. And then those can be sold throughout the country, not in siloed markets, for cheaper than anything that could be produced in a regulated market. It's untaxed, unregulated, not age-gated, and can be sent through the U.S. mail.
This is the great hemp loophole of which you addressed the Secretary of Agriculture then, right?
I did, and it's related to the cannabis tax issue, because it makes the cannabis tax issue, the very high taxes that we see that are layered onto cannabis products, both from the state level and from local jurisdictions who see permitting cannabis locally as a way to raise local tax revenue. And so when all of these taxes are compounded, and we recently restructured the taxes and got rid of the cultivation tax, which is great because no other agricultural commodity is taxed at the farm level, and it doesn't make sense to do that. But the taxes that were promised from Prop 64, and this is one of those problems with Prop 64, is the tax rates were baked into it. And so they're very difficult for the legislature to change. It's a matter of law. So the cannabis taxes are very high. The regulated cannabis has to compete not just with the black market, duty-free market in California, but also has to compete with an edibles market that is hemp-derived from outside of California, from places like Texas and North Carolina, where they are growing hemp the same way we grow cannabis in California. For oil or for cannabinoids. Basically, they're growing it for human consumption. And so these products can cross state lines, and they are a third of the price and three times the potency, if not more. I've seen products that really should not be in, you know, convenience stores or sold through e-commerce. And they're untaxed, and they're untested. You know, one of the benefits of having a regulated cannabis system is that all of the products are tested, and cannabis is tested to parts per billion. Food is not tested that way. Cannabis is one of the the safest consumer product for human consumption when it comes to all sorts of contaminants that could end up being in agricultural products. And so this is one of the main benefits of the regulated system. But what is the point at which the consumer chooses the tested product over the one that costs a third of the price? And that's really the issue that we're seeing in California cannabis. But it's also an issue that we're going to start seeing around the country as state regulators try and figure out what to do with unlimited amounts of intoxicating cannabinoids sold without testing, regulation, or age gating.
You say you find them at the convenience store?
One can, absolutely. And one can also find them. Let me give you an example. There's a new restaurant. I'm giving them a plug, I guess. It's called Buds and Brews. And it's in Nashville. And they sell sauces that are, the sauces are infused. And they're infused with hemp-derived Delta-9 THC. And it's hemp derived because what the company is doing is they are growing legal CBD, and they are taking that CBD and they're putting it through a chemical process and turning it in to the active ingredient in cannabis, Delta-9 tetrahydrocannabinol. And as long as the concentration of the THC is less than 0.3% on a dry weight basis, then that product is legal. And that doesn't sound like a lot, 0.3%. Well, we measure food in this country, we measure it in grams. We measure cannabinoids in milligrams. So what may seem like a small percentage actually can be quite a lot. And the percentage of Delta-9 tetrahydrocannabinol that is allowed in a consumer product, in many cases, based on the weight of that product, it can exceed the amount that is allowed in the regulated cannabis market. And so it doesn't seem to make sense. So for the farmer, this is really insulting for the hemp farmer, because the hemp farmer can have their crop tested hot, over 0.3% on a dry weight basis in the raw biomass, and that farmer will have to destroy their crop. But if that farmer can get their crop to a processor at less than 0.3% on a dry weight basis, that processor is going to extract the CBD, turn the CBD into THC, and then put that THC in consumer products that exceed the allowed concentration in regulated cannabis. I know that sounds very confusing, and I apologize. And that's one of the reasons why I was talking to Secretary Ross, because this is a complicated and nuanced issue, and it clearly wasn't what Congress intended. Yeah. Congress did not intend to legalize marijuana, but they did in terms of final form products. And so that's one of the issues that I wanted to raise during the listening session, was this is the problem, and we need to work together and bring stakeholders together to find a solution to this that is respectful of the botany, because the plant doesn't know that it's hemp or marijuana. Well, the plant just knows itself to be cannabis sativa L.
Let me see if I can kind of paraphrase what you said. Let's say you have a 10-foot tall hemp plant, And if it has more than 0.3 milligrams of THC, then it's considered to be cannabis. Less
0.3%
than
0.3% on a dry weight basis.
0.3%. Okay. You dry the 10-foot tall plant, and if it's 0.3% of THC, it's restricted. If it's less than, then it's just hemp. But
correct.
If you take that 10-foot tall plant and you put it in the ultimate reduction machine so that it shrinks down to a gram of weight, and that 0.3% becomes very powerful.
That's pretty close, but yes, you're right. Here's the issue is the farm bill.
Well, before we go to the farm bill, going to have to take a really quick break. Then we'll be right back. My goodness sakes, with Joanna Cedar, hemp policy expert, Terpene Belt Farms, right back.
History buffs, this tale from Michael Olson's Tales from a Tin Can took place aboard the USS Dale at Eniwetok, February 1944.
We got detached for some close-in shore bombardment on one of the little coral islands. From a distance, they're just little slivers of white and green separating the blue sea and sky. Somehow we found ourselves blasting away with our 5-inchers from one side of the island while the big old battleships on the other side were booming away with their giant 16-inch rifles. Trouble was, the trajectory of their rounds was flat, so a bunch of those 16-inch shells hit that round slip of coral and ricocheted right off in our direction. You could hear them roaring past right over our head, and they didn't sound friendly at all. Captain said, "Let's get the hell out of here."
Tales from a Tin Can contains 424 tales by 44 sailors aboard the USS Dale, from Pearl Harbor to Tokyo Bay. Order your Father's Day copy at talesfromatincan.com. That's talesfromatincan.com. Talesfromatincan.com.
Come on, you watch the news. Be prepared to pay more taxes. Then if you owe back taxes or haven't filed in a few years, get ready. The IRS, the largest collection agency in the world, will be coming after you with the power to collect taxes by any means they want to. Hey, they can freeze your bank account, your passport, even padlock your business. Oh, good times. Look, if the IRS claims you owe them $5,000 or more in back taxes and they're coming after you, don't panic. Call my friends at Get a Tax Lawyer first. Their job is to negotiate with the IRS and save you money. They're experts at it. That's all they do. And you can trust them. In some cases, they have reduced a $50,000 tax bill to less than $1,000. If you owe the IRS $5,000 or more in back taxes, call now for a free consultation.
Call 800-661-5096. 800-661-5096. 800-661-5096. That's 800-661-5096.
Are you nearly maxed out on your credit cards? It doesn't matter if you're using your credit cards for fun or to survive. At the end of the month, your statements come in, and you can either pay them or you can't. If you can't, late fees and interest rates get tacked on. And now, you're struggling just to make the minimum payment due. Do you feel trapped? Am I talking to you? Good, because I personally researched some companies that can help you. They may be able to reduce your credit card balances by 50% and stop the late fees. If you qualify, please call our special debt hotline number right now for a complimentary, free 5-minute consultation. Deal with your credit card problem now before it gets much worse and put more money back in your pocket. Trust me, I've been there too. Call right now.
800-370-8128. 800-370-8128. 800-370-8128. That's 800-370-8128.
Well, ladies and gentlemen, there is a very big loophole in the cannabis industry, as described by Joanna Cedar here. It seems like you can take a 10-foot tall plant and have it measure out to be 0.3% THC. And it'd be legal. But if you could take that 10-foot tall plant and reduce it to the size of a dollar bill or a quarter, and that was 0.3%, that would be much more powerful and intoxicating. And therefore, all of the laws that have been established to regulate the potency of cannabis seem to have been constructed with this giant hemp loophole. Is that right, Joanna?
Pretty much. You know, it really gets back to the nature of the Farm Bill. The Farm Bill is really meant to regulate agriculture, and it's meant to regulate hemp in the field as biomass, as a raw material. In this country, final form consumer products for human consumption are regulated by the FDA. But in the Farm Bill gave the USDA the right to regulate hemp in its entirety. And so here's the crux of our present problem. There are lots of new products. If nothing else, the cannabis and hemp people, we are creative. We had to be creative because there have been so many constraints on the development of our industry. So we are creative people. And we have found pathways to bring this plant to market. But the USDA does not regulate final form goods. And the FDA has yet to been given the statutory authority to do so. And so that was really one of the things that I wanted to impart to the to regulators at CDFA, because they have to figure out how to address this issue in California. They would like to restrict hemp-derived intoxicating cannabinoids in California because we have a regulated market that is managed by the Department of Cannabis Control, which is separate from CDFA. So some of the industry is regulated at CDFA, and some of the industry is regulated at the Department of Cannabis Control, but equal products can be, final form consumer products can be produced or by both regulatory structures. That this is playing out in California maybe first, but it's going to play out in all of the states with all state regulators trying to figure out what they can do here so that they can have a regulatory system that is so that final form products are tested and safe, but also that consumers understand what they are consuming. And I think that this is a really important issue. Many consumers have been told that hemp is non-intoxicating. And so when they see hemp derived, they believe it to be non-intoxicating, many of them. And that's not always the case, because the most intoxicating cannabinoid products on the market today are not cannabis derived. They're hemp derived, because on the cannabis side, there are restrictions, and on the hemp side, there are no restrictions yet.
The great hemp loophole.
Exactly, because the FDA has not regulated yet. And so this is really what I'm hoping that CDFA and our local congressional delegation, our California congressional delegation, this is the message that we hope that they will take to Washington when they are asked to give input regarding the reauthorization of the Farm Bill. And that's the message that I took to the listening session, and that's the message that I hope that they take to Washington. And so I work with state and federal advocacy organizations in the hopes that, you know, the learning curve is steep on this. And even hemp and cannabis people aren't aware of the depth that this problem can cause. And I'm not making this up. Oh, well, this is Joanna's interpretation. No, there's local, state, and federal courts that have looked at this and have agreed with this interpretation that if it's hemp derived and it is less than 0.3% on a dry weight basis, even in a final form product, then it is legal. And the only cannabinoid, the only one that is restricted, is Delta-9 THC. All other cannabinoids, some of which are 30 times more potent than Delta-9 THC, can be included in final form consumer products in unlimited concentrations because the FDA has yet to speak on this issue. So when they do,
go ahead.
They have to be given direction. And the only way that they can be given direction is by addressing this issue in the reauthorization of the Farm Bill.
Wow. Well, let me back up.
Yeah, it's a lot.
Now, let me back up a little bit and talk about the impact of legalization. We're in the federal, state, county, and city governments all jumped on the industry and loaded it up with all kinds of rules and regulations and taxes. And then that effect always, when that happens by government with an industry, is that all the little folks disappear and all the big folks dominate because they have the wherewithal to fight for their place at the supper table, as it were. Now, you represent Terpene Belt Farms. Tell us a little bit about your farm.
Sure, I'd love to. Terpene Belt is really an innovative farm. So Terpene Belt is a subsidiary of Eden Enterprises, which is a vertically integrated cannabis company that has operated with full local control in Alameda County since 2003. So almost 20 years. And one of the product lines that Eden produces are vape cartridges. And the way that vape cartridges are produced is through extraction. And in that extraction process, what happens is the terpenes that we talked about before that determine the type of effect, those terpenes are lost. They're volatile compounds, and they are lost. In fact, if people live, especially in farming regions or traditional legacy producing regions in California, they know that in late September and early October, it smells like cannabis everywhere. And what people are smelling are the terpenes. They're volatile compounds that off-gas as soon as the plant is cut from the stalk. So as they are lost and as the product, the vape cartridges are produced, those terpenes have to be added back in. Well, that's a difficult thing to do. Now, you can get terpenes from other sources, botanical sources, but it's best to add cannabis terpenes into a cannabis vape product. It's the best way of getting a whole plant effect. Mm-hmm. So, but cannabis is expensive to grow in California. And most people do not harvest cannabis for the terpenes. They harvest it for the whole plant. So where was Eden going to get these terpenes? And they decided that they were going to grow hemp. Those hemp cultivars were going to be specifically bred to mimic the terpene profiles of in popular cannabis cultivars. And we were going to grow it on an industrial scale and build a state-of-the-art steam distillation facility on farm. And so now we have about 250 acres in production. It's all on-farm steam distilled terpenes. And these terpenes are now a B2B product. It's a business-to-business product. We use them for our own vape cartridges. We sell them to companies like ours that produce cannabis vapes. But we also sell these terpenes to traditional CPG companies that want to use hemp terpenes in beverages or in foods or in any other consumer product where one might want the traditional aroma and flavor of cannabis.
Wow. Amazing.
It's a great pivot. So, I feel thrilled to be able to work for a company that is this innovative.
Mm-hmm. Now, are a lot of people consuming cannabis via the vape now?
A lot do. In 2019, there was something that we call the vape crisis or e-valley crisis, and I think there were people who were using cannabis vapes that ended up with serious lung disease, and one of the reasons for that was because they were inhaling acetates, and I think what that did, that whole process forced cannabis vape manufacturers to be very, very careful with what they put into cannabis vaporizer products. And so now we've seen an industry that is now very focused on safety and focused on having only cannabis ingredients in the cannabis vape products. And so a lot of people do like the vape products because they are they're easy, they are discreet, and they have the desired effect.
Mm-hmm. And it's evidently a pretty substantial business then. If you have that many acres going, it's very substantial.
Yeah, now, and our products can cross state lines because they're hemp derived and they're cannabinoid free.
Right.
So they do not get you high. And they're cannabinoid free, they cross state lines, and so it's been a wonderful opportunity to actually see the Cannabis Sativa L plant as a agricultural crop, and also to see how differently it is treated when it's on the hemp side, mm-hmm, versus on the cannabis side.
So it's interesting. You're going for the taste and the bouquet,
correct,
rather than the intoxicant.
Yes.
Wow.
The intoxicants, well, it's the aforementioned, you can break apart the components and then recompile them into something that suits the consumer.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I'm personally a flower girl. I like to smoke flower and I like to grow flower and I love flower. But I also understand that there are people who prefer different products. And in the lab, one can create specific terpene profiles designed specifically for a particular person.
Yeah.
So we're right at the beginning of, cannabis vapes by design. People soon will be able to order up particular terpene profiles.
Now, this kind of leads me to my question of the day, which is, can the government gain total control of cannabis? What do you think?
Nor should they try. Nor should they try. But I think that what they tried with alcohol, right, to gain total control. And for the most part, you know, people don't create, they don't create grain alcohol in their backyard. There really is a difference between cannabis for mass-produced cannabis and cottage cannabis. And I think what the government should really look at is they should look at, you know, what is the final form consumer product that is being sold and at what scale? Somebody who, you know, can grow tomatoes in their backyard, process those tomatoes into tomato sauce and sell it to their neighbors, there are cottage laws that protect that. And I think that we missed an opportunity, especially in Northern California, to treat cannabis as if it was a cottage crop.
Isn't it legal for, individuals to grow, six plants?
To grow it, but not to sell it to their neighbors. Uh-huh. They can give it away to their neighbors, but not to sell it to their neighbors. But I do think that they missed an opportunity to treat small-scale cannabis cultivation as a cottage crop in California. There are also, if we take the analogy for just a minute to alcohol, specifically to beer, and extend it, there's Budweiser and there's craft beer that one can get at a local brewery. And I think that we also missed an opportunity here to treat them differently, to treat cannabis. You know, we put cannabis in one big pot, and we decided that large-scale cannabis cultivation is identical to small-scale cannabis cultivation, and that large-scale production of cannabis final form consumer goods is identical to small scale. And we tried to treat them all and have the same regulations associated with them. And I don't think that was a good approach.
Okay, so then I have one last question for you. If
sure.
you could wave a magic wand and have the right to write a provision in the next farm bill, what would it be?
Well, they've already legalized cannabis in the Farm Bill, all except for high THC flower and high THC inhalables derived from cannabis. They already legalized cannabis. They don't realize it, and most people don't realize it. But I think if I could wave a magic wand over the Farm Bill, is I would tell them that they should empower the FDA to regulate final form consumer products. They should empower the USDA to be responsible for both hemp and cannabis cultivation in the field. And I would give more leeway to farmers and let them grow whatever crop they want, regardless of THC level. And they could decide, well, this is flower that can be sold as flower. This is flower that needs to go into an extraction facility.
Do I hear you asking for freedom?
Yes, for the farmer in particular. The farmer always gets screwed.
All right, Joanna, we're out of time, but I got to thank you. You've been absolutely great, and thank you for watching out for our world and for your great explanation of what's eating what up and down the cannabis food chain. Much appreciated.
Been a pleasure to be with you. Thank you.
You bet.